There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
The Book of Job podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome or welcome back. You have found the most interesting baseball podcast on the planet. It's The Book of Joe with me, Tom Verducci, and of course, Joe Madden. And Joe, I'm going to start off with our leadoff hitter, which is Mike Trout. Yeah, Mike Trout leading off for the Los Angeles Angels on Tuesday night. And I think, Joe, the last time he did it was for you back in 2020 in the second game of a doubleheader.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
I you know what? I don't distinctly remember that, but it's something I used to do often if a guy was struggling at all. As opposed to moving him down, I would move him up. That started out in the minor leagues in 1985 with Kevin King in Midland, Texas. Big guy, looked like Don Baylor. Struggled in the first half, hit .233 with 7 homers, ended up hitting .300 with 30 just by moving him up to the leadoff spot. So it's a different mindset. You approach it differently. Nobody's better leadoff hitter in history than Anthony Rizzo. Rizzo used to giggle about that, but I'd prefer moving up than moving down.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because obviously the Angels were scuffling a little bit. Mike was scuffling a little bit. Mm-hmm. Ron Washington went up to Mike Trout, of course, and asked him about it. And you know, Mike, he's like, whatever you want to do.
That's right. That's right.
I'm good.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think Michael really wants to hit leadoff. He'd prefer not. But under the circumstances, like I said, it's just rearranging the chairs on the deck. You know, you just do that. I did it with Longo. Longo didn't like it, but there was a time he was really struggling. I moved Longo up there, and it goes back. I think I was like kind of maybe influenced by Gene Mauch with Brian Downing. Nobody understood why Gene hit Brian first, but Brian had such a great eye at the plate. He accepted his walks. He got hit by a pitch a lot. He had power. It's almost like Schwarber could put a 1-0 before you know it. So, again, we've had such a preconceived mental notion of what a leadoff hitter is supposed to look like, and even for years, what's number two supposed to look like? And, you know, they're supposed to be the guy that could bunt and hit and run and all this other stuff. For me, I always wanted my number two guy to make sure that my number three guy got up there with the runner in scoring position. That was my 80s mentality with it. So, yeah, it's an interesting situation. It's an interesting spot, and I think it's one of those things you have to rethink based on your personnel.
Yeah, and listen, it's kind of like the weather, right? Everybody likes talking about lineup construction, but right. I'm not sure that there's a big effect here, especially short term. You know, listen, I don't like the idea of Mike Trout batting leadoff, except you want to shake things up. I get that. The idea that you're guaranteeing he takes his first at bat of the game with nobody on base, and the fact that after that he's following the number 9 spot in the order, which has a .281 on base percentage for the Angels, I don't like sending Mike Trout up to the plate that many times with nobody on base. I'm sorry. Over the long haul, it does not make sense. Short term, sure. It's a different look. It shakes things up. You know, Joe, you know this. Sometimes you have to do something that's a little bit unorthodox, so you look at a problem or an approach in a very different way. I think as a change of scenery, if you will, it can work. I would never leave him there long term, though.
One of the things when I was with the Cubs as a National League manager, I used to occasionally hit the pitcher 8th and a position player 9th, and a lot of it was to feed 1-2. I just did not like the pitcher coming up before Dexter or if I wanted KB in the two hole as an example. So I actually, Pete Rose asked me about that once at a card show. Hey, why do you hit the pitcher eight? So that was part of it. The other part of it, in the National League lineup, I wanted to clear him sooner because, of course, he's got to hit every time up. If you clear him sooner, you get a sooner opportunity to possibly pinch hit for him in a hotter situation, that number eight spot. So I liked it for that. I really got to like it a lot for that particular reason, but I also felt somewhat better to have a position player hitting in front of one and two.
Yeah, well, listen, we've seen it, Joe, how the leadoff spot has really changed over time. You know, if you go back to the 70s and you had guys like Omar Moreno hitting leadoff for the Pirates just because he was fast. He didn't get on base. He had no power, but he was fast, so he batted leadoff. If you look historically, the three seasons with the most home runs out of the leadoff spot, 2019, 2021, and 2023. Teams are packing their lineup with power at the top. Now, listen, there's more power in the game anyway. I get that. But people want home run hitters at the top of the lineup. On base percentage, last year it was 340 at a leadoff spot. That was the most in the last 14 years. But in baseball history, that's only 61st.
Wow.
So it's they're not getting on base as much, but they are slugging more. That's kind of typical what the game is. You think about speed. Yeah, of course, last year stolen bases went up because of the new rules. But still, we still haven't got back to even a 2014 level, not even close to it in terms of stolen bases at the leadoff spot. So the leadoff spot is different. It's almost like your number two or three hitter back in the day is now in that leadoff spot. What do you think, Joe, about guys hitting leadoff? Can anybody hit leadoff? Have you had people who told you, I don't like to hit leadoff? What about the kind of the mental component to hitting leadoff?
I think that's the biggest part of it, honestly. I mean, Carl Crawford did not want to hit leadoff, and I love CC, but CC, he loved the two-hole. It was his comfort zone. He wanted to be in the two-hole, so I might have done it a couple times with him, but I know he would always fight back on it, so I did not want to do that. I know Mike Trout did not necessarily like to do that, so I didn't want to push him on that either. But the big one was Carl, because Carl, you would think, perfectly fit into that role, but he really did not like it. On the other hand, Schwarber, when I had Schwarbs in with the Cubs early on in his career, I wanted him to hit leadoff. I thought it was you talked about it kind of there with the combination of power, and I thought on base percentage, I thought he would accept his walks. But the strikeout became so prominent the first time he tried it that it really kind of washed out, and of course it took the second time. Again, not a prototypical leadoff hitter, but wow, 40-some homers, and then they're leading 1-0 a lot when he does that. So, yeah, it's a combination of things, a combination of thoughts. It's the mentality of the player. On the other hand, like Dexter Fowler loved it. And Dexter would go through some periods, man, where he punched out a lot, where he would disappear offensively. But, man, when he got hot, he'd carry it for weeks or months. I mean, it's a mindset. It's not mining to be the first guy up there. Some are not uncomfortable. They want to see a couple pitches. They want somebody to come back and see what they're seeing, et cetera. So it is. It's a mentality. If you get the right kind of blend of ability, skill set, where the guy knows how to accept his walks, gets on base, has a little pop, can at least put the ball in the gap. Like Zobrist. I mean, Ben was not, you know, prototypical anything, but Zo was really good at that because he was on base a lot, but he had some pop. And he did not mind doing it. Zoe was the consummate utility guy. So I think it comes down to a combination of skill set, and you have to have the right mindset to want to do it.
Yeah, it reminds me of Ichiro Suzuki. He used to love hitting leadoff, especially on the road, because, and this is typical Ichiro, he would say the batter's box was perfect, undisturbed, almost like a Zen garden.
That's right.
I was going to say, let's talk about Mike Trout, okay? Because I think we're looking now at a different phase of Mike Trout's career. And actually, we've seen it the last couple of years. Mike Trout, to me, is going to hit, if he stays healthy, 50 home runs this year. Okay. He has become a premier slugger. He's not going to be the average hitter that he was before. He'll steal a few bases, but you know, you don't want him running a lot. But when you look at the type of hitter Mike Trout has become, he is an extreme fly ball hitter. He pulls the ball a lot more than he did in the past. He swings and misses more than he does in the past. But when he connects, he's hitting home runs. When he's hitting fly balls, they're going out at a tremendous rate. He has 9 home runs and 12 RBIs this year. So if I'm telling you, Joe, I believe if Mike Trout plays a full season, he's going to hit at least 50 home runs. And I think he's become a premier slugger rather than we used to talk about Mike as the best hitter in baseball. Right now, I think that's Shohei Ohtani. But in terms of elite slugger, that's the way I look at Mike Trout right now.
Well, again, if you want to go that direction with him, there's a lot of comps there with Schwarber in a sense, because for me, Kyle's always hit a lot of solo home runs. And I think if Mike continues to hit like at the top of the batting order, he might get pitched at a little bit more. But if you put him a little bit more deeply into the lineup, and this is a weird philosophy, but like with Schwarber too, I don't think he gets his pitch hit a home run with as often. I mean, pitchers know that. There's people on base. I'm not going to, you know, just challenge him in this situation, whether it's a breaking ball strike or even velocity down, which Michael loves. So I think there's a component to that too. When you see homers and a little number of RBIs, these are the guys that are getting challenged with nobody on base. Not so much with people on. Troy Glaus for a while did that early on in his career also with the Angels. I used to see a big homer number and not such a big RBI number because he gets challenged more with nobody on. Just watch that stuff. I'm a believer in that. There's a certain group that they're so respected by the other side that they get pitched at differently with RBI situation versus not.
Yeah, Mike Trout right now, 10 singles, 9 home runs. So when he hits the ball, it's going out. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you about a situation the other night before Mike hit leadoff. He made the last out of the game against the Baltimore Orioles. Bases loaded, bottom of the ninth inning, Craig Kimbrell on the mound. And you know this is a matchup, what Kimbrell is going to try to do. Kimbrell's got that high angle fastball top of the zone. We all know that's the one place pitchers like to attack Mike Trout, fastballs at the top of the zone. Mike looked at 4 pitches. 3 of those were strikes. He struck out for the last out of the game without swinging the bat.
Wow.
And then after the game, Ron Washington said, "You've just got to swing the bat there." And I think some people, when they saw the quote, Joe, took it as the manager sort of calling out Mike Trout. I didn't have a problem with it. I mean, it's pretty obvious. I'm sure Mike would say the same thing. I mean, he obviously wasn't seeing that fastball as well as he thought. You know, Mike has done a good job staying off the high fastballs out of the zone, and he must have thought they were out of the zone. But listen, I go back to the days where managers like Billy Martin, Dallas Green, Davey Johnson, these managers would call out players on a daily basis. I mean, feelings would be hurt all the time and the manager didn't care. So in today's game, when you have a manager who says about Mike Trout, "You've just got to swing the bat there," eyebrows get raised. Right. And I'm sure Ron Washington did not mean it as a complaint or a criticism of Mike Trout. He's basically stating the obvious. But in today's world, man, you say the most innocuous thing and the media is going to say, "Whoa, he called him out."
All I would be curious is whether or not Wash had said something to him before he actually went into the press room, possibly as they're passing, walking up the tunnel. But you're right. I probably would not have said that. I don't think I would have said that for the reasons you just explained. You know, we as a major league managers, you have 2 press conferences a day, and I thought there were 2 team meetings per day. I would try to use that time to send messages to the group, not necessarily individuals, because the guys either watch it, they watch the feed after the game, they'll see the little snippets played that night or read the newspaper online the next day. So I always thought it was a great way of communicating to the players without actually having them sit in a room like that. So That's how I looked at all of that. But I probably, when it came down to calling out a player, I think you and I have talked about this. I always thought praise publicly, criticize privately. And again, like you're saying, it's not hypercritical. I think Wash was just stating the obvious, like you said. I don't think he thought anything of it. What he said right there was just reacting to him as a baseball player. Also, he's a former major league player. He's gone through that situation 1,000 times. And I'm sure he's had that conversation with players in the past. So I think it was just, like you said, totally innocuous, however it can be construed differently. But yeah, I think as a major league manager, my impression is it's a perfect opportunity on a daily basis to really emphasize to the group, whether it's praise or maybe not so much praiseworthy, but nevertheless, you're still getting messages across because you know the guys are watching and listening.
Especially in today's environment. Mm-hmm. You're right. It's just the media also is watching and listening closely. Mostly, mm-hmm. You know this, Joe, what is said mm-hmm. in those meetings, it's pretty vanilla. It's boilerplate stuff. So if anything ventures outside the norm, it gets a lot more attention. And I go back to when Joe Girardi was the Yankees manager and Gary Sanchez was having a tough time defensively behind the plate. Mm-hmm. And he had a rough game. You know, some wild pitches, balls he didn't stop. And the only thing Joe Girardi said was, we've got to be better back there. And he, I don't want to say he lost Gary Sanchez, but he kind of lost confidence, Gary Sanchez did, in his manager, because mm-hmm. he did feel like his manager was calling him out. Mm-hmm. I saw it as someone who's been around the game for a long time as something innocuous, but today's young player is just does not get criticized, not publicly. And when I say criticize, I'm not right. saying get mildly. Ripped, mm-hmm. but yeah. anything that's along the lines of it wasn't a great job. And I think that's today's manager. You know this, Joe. You have to be super careful with younger players, this generation of players, in how you quote unquote criticize them.
Even away from that, too, even like just in a normal day routine of the day, because you and I both, and I'm not trying to state anything or pat anybody on the back, whatever you want to consider it, but played for a lot tougher, the high school football coaches coming on up, even some of the baseball coaches could be very cruel in their assessment of you, and I kind of liked it. I did like when I considered a guy to be really competent as a coach, he got on me. I don't think one time I ever got aired out by a coach that I thought, kind of screw him. What are you talking about here? I just always took it to heart. I don't even know the way I've always described it more recently is that when you do that as a manager, whether it's in a private situation or even publicly, a lot of players will look for allies and they're going to get sympathy from other players. I like the group that doesn't provide sympathy to the player that's been called out. I prefer that they would actually say, you know what? He was right. The manager was right. He's not trying to embarrass you. He's just trying to state the obvious and hopefully get you to do better in a situation. So that's what happens, allies. And that's where cliques are developed, especially in today's world, not just in baseball. Because when you attempt to be constructively critical, I think that a lot of times the person, the target of the criticism looks for allies. And that's where it can get kind of difficult. And that's where I think a well-structured clubhouse, when that is attempted to happen, somebody tries to do that, they're going to hear back from, listen, man, no, he was right. Or go talk to him, something to that effect. But I'm not going to be here and just to comfort you because probably or possibly this other guy has felt slighted in the past too.
Yeah, well said. And, the extreme example for me is someone who covered George Steinbrenner. Man, mm-hmm. if you played for the Yankees, you could not have thin skin. Mm-hmm. I mean, at one time when Dave Rigetti blew a game, Steinbrenner called him out and he said he should be so embarrassed he should walk out of the ballpark with the hot dog vendors. Of course, famously, he called Dave Winfield Mr. May. He said, Reggie's Mr. October. We have Mr. May here. This went on and I all the time. And that was the way George thought he was motivating the players. And in some ways he did back then. And I think your point about clubhouse culture was super important, Joe, because mm-hmm. I saw around the Yankees then, no one got their egos bruised when George Steinbrenner called them out. They sort of rallied circled the wagons and rallied amongst each other. Like, let's go show that guy. It was us against them at that point. And I think that's what he was trying to do. That sort of negative motivation, I'm not saying it's the right thing to do. It's just the way it was back then. It can't happen anymore because I don't think the clubhouse would rally around negative motivation. It would fracture.
I think if you have a bunch of veterans that are really tough-minded, it's almost like watching an episode on Seinfeld when Steinbrenner's on there and Larry David's being his voice. They'll laugh at it. They really will. They'll laugh at it among each other. You can't laugh at it in front of Mr. Steinbrenner. You can't laugh at it to a newspaper reporter. But because, listen, I've heard a lot of great stories about that, and there's others. Other kind of coaches or managers that may have been a little bit more on the negative side and said things that in the moment sound absolutely awful. But when a group gets together, it's kind of funny. I mean, that's the best way to really get through situations like that. Always consider the source. Always consider the source. Where's it coming from? And what kind of esteem do you hold that source within? And I've been with a lot of guys, man, and I'll hear different things that were said in the clubhouse by either Steinbrenner or others. And man, it could be very biting, no question. And it can maybe sting in the beginning, but when it's a tightly knit group, a lot of times you just laugh at it pretty hard.
Hey, as long as we're on the subject of creating some friction, when we get back, we're going to talk about one of Joe's favorite topics, and that is umpires.
Mm.
We'll be back with that right after this.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
People don't always realize just how much their negative thoughts and experiences stick with them and weigh them down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mom does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapist anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Book of Joe today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Book of Joe.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Umpires, Joe. Listen, we don't hear a lot about friction between managers and umpires. This is the replay era, right? I mean, you have replay to take away arguments on the bases, and so all you've got left is balls and strikes. And we saw I've never seen anything like this the other day, where Aaron Boone was thrown out of the game by Hunter Wendelstedt because of something a fan said. Just to recap the story, it was just five pitches into the game. Aaron Boone does have a reputation. I mean, to me, he gets thrown out way too often. And he's got to really dial it back a little bit. But anyway, he went off, and Hunter Wendelstedt said, that's it. Anything more, you know, you're basically out of here. And a fan in the front row directly behind Aaron Boone said something to Wendelstedt. Wendelstedt obviously thought it was Aaron Boone or somebody in the dugout and immediately threw him out of the game. So Aaron Boone got ejected for not saying anything at that point. And from what Aaron Boone said, he was not fined by MLB, which is a winking nod that Hunter Wendelstedt was wrong in this situation. First, Joe, I'm sure you saw some of it. You heard about it. Give me your take on what you first thought when you saw something like that happen.
And the other one is check swings, balls and strikes and check swings. Those are the ones right. That get me. Check swings got me in more trouble than anything. Well, I did see it. And, of course, I know everybody involved. And I know Hunter well. Hunter and I have always gotten along well. But Hunter could be kind of like that, very definitive. No, that's it. And my problem with that line is that if an umpire ever told me, that's it, I've had enough. If they threaten me like that, he said something to the effect that if you say one more word, whatever, you're out of here, something like that, then I'm out of there. I mean, I just where I come from, right? You've been to Hazleton, Pennsylvania. When you get kind of pushed like that, it's hard not to push back, man. It's like the only thing I can think about, that was the first inning. So you might just like rein it back in because it's so early in the game. I think part of that would be, how's it been going lately? You know, do I want an early exit here? Do I'm trying to rile the boys up a little bit? Maybe as an opportunity to take advantage of this situation. But I whenever an umpire just like drew the line, I don't know if I've ever did not cross the line when it was drawn. And in that situation, for sure, I could see with Aaron's perspective. I mean, he didn't say anything after his original outburst, whatever. And it's tough. It's tough when that happens. It's just an emotional. When you're in the dugout in front of your entire ball club. And the other thing you have to understand, when something like that happens, every set of eyeballs comes right at you. I don't really know that because people have told me that, or I'll look back after the moment's over, like everybody's staring at you. So they're always looking to see how you're going to react, which is important. And so I really want my group, my players, to maintain that respect for me So even though I don't want to get kicked out, I still have to do what I have to do to not lose that respect of the players, even if I have to argue with an umpire that maybe I do respect also. So there's this really, all those thoughts go in your head weirdly in that moment. Last point, if I really dig an umpire, and I, you know, especially the veteran umpires that I had so much respect for, it would get to a point where it'd be kind of a tough moment where I really needed to say or do something about it. I would not cross the line. I had the guys that you really feel are good at their jobs and you could communicate with. I'd only go so far. I would not go over that line. And it's something I learned, you know, in the minor leagues. I got ejected so often early on in my minor league career, I think 7 times in a half season in the Northwest League, which is only 70 games. So I got better at that as I went along. But the thing is, like, these guys have a really difficult job. And don't, just to the point where umpires don't sit down for 9 innings. They're standing up there the whole time. That's not easy to do for me, just to focus and concentrate like that. So, yeah, the greater respect I have for the umpire, the less likely I'm going to cross the line. But if they do put the line out there, I'm going to cross it almost every time.
Yeah, that's the Hazleton in you, no doubt. I'm going to go next level on you here on what's behind that. Because I see a real bifurcation with umpires these days, the younger ones and the veteran umpires. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, the better umpires are the younger umpires. They mm-hmm. They've basically done their whole professional careers with the ball tracking systems that are in place. I see in umpires like Hunter Wendelstedt, that old school version, that when you're the home plate umpire, it's my game. That's the way they think of it. It's my game. And I am the arbiter of the game, not just the balls and the strikes. And he sees it as an affront when challenged from the dugout. And I don't see that from the younger umpires, Joe. I think the younger umpires are more willing to say, you know what, I missed it, and move on. I don't think controlling managers and players and the game itself is being done by the younger umpires. They've been trained totally differently. And I get it. If you're an older veteran umpire, you're Angel Hernandez, you're Hunter Wendelstedt, those games were in your hands. You were in charge with the pace of the game. That's now done by a clock. Just the way guys comport themselves. You were in control of that. And I don't think the younger umpires today see that as part of their jobs. I mean, obviously, you're going to have to rein somebody in if they're completely over the top. But I think an older veteran umpire like Hunter Wendelstedt, that's more old school, where this is my game and you're going to stop it right now. I don't think you see that from the younger umpires.
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything you just said there. I'll just say this, though. Again, getting back to my argumentative component. I would more easily argue with a young umpire because I didn't know him. I part of not wanting to take the lineup card up to home plate is I didn't want to get to know the younger guys coming into the league that well, because I knew the older guys from being a bench coach and I was always going up to the plate. You get to know these guys and it's harder. I mean, it's harder, I think. I mean, maybe that's just me. It's harder to argue with somebody that you know and you kind of like. So if I really needed to stir it up a little bit, I would pick a younger umpire. Not that I didn't think he was any good or I didn't like him. I just didn't know him. So it's easier to argue. It's just the human element. So that's part of it for me as a manager for several years. And then what you're talking about there regarding their mentality or their the method with which their bedside manner, they have so many supervisors now. I mean, they're coming up legitimately with supervisors being reviewing arguments or situations or things that the other guys, when they came up years ago, did not. It was just primarily umpire schools, right? Brinkman, Wendelstedt, umpire schools. I mean, guys went through that, which I really never understood why MLB's never taken total charge of the way umpires are developed, although I think it's more along those lines today. But supervisors, and I knew a lot of the supervisors and how Dick Nelson was famous for years. Dick Nelson was in charge of minor league umpires for 100 years. He and I had a great relationship, and whenever I got tossed, whenever I'd be able to talk to him and talk to as to why it happened and gave him my perspective and he would listen. So I think the supervision and the teaching that goes with this, and then the accountability because of technology with these young guys. Yeah, it is. They're developing a more homogenized product, a group that's more in line because, as you stated, you could name all the old umpires. You could, if you've been around long enough, you could almost tell what their strike zone was. They were up, down, in or out, or both. You could tell how far you can go. You could, if you could go at all, if you could even say anything to these guys or not. You knew all of that before the game began. So that was part of the conversation, whether or not you could talk to the guy, his strike zone is going to be like, it's going to be big, but don't say anything because if you do, it's going to get worse, things like that. That was a part of the conversation today. You'll get a heat map before the game. You'll see what a home plate umpire is like, and you could pretty much bank on it. He's going to be either wide outside to right on right, left on left. There's a heat map for right versus left, left versus right, same side. And you look at the heat maps, they're pretty solid, man. So players and coaches and pitchers know going into the game what this is going to look like, and it's more homogenized than it had been.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Joe, I don't miss those days at all. When the umpires, you know, they, if you were a young player, you had a different strike zone than a veteran player. You know, if you complained, your strike zone got bigger. I hated the individual strike zones from the umpires. It's so much better now. I think the umpires and generally, as, again, the younger ones here, way less confrontational, you know, walking away from arguments rather than walking toward them. You could say it's taken some of the color out of the game. I don't miss it. I didn't like the fact that umpires were part of the show. And I think they blend into the scenery a lot more. I think they're trained better. And I love the fact that the strike zone is, for the most part, very homogenized. And, you know, maybe someday we're going to get to a point where there's a challenge system, which I would be in favor of, not a full-on robo umpire behind the plate, but the batter, pitcher, catcher could call, say, three pitches a game under review. And it's done in 5 seconds. It's done in the minor leagues. I'd be in favor of that. I don't want to get rid of these umpires and the human element, but I do like the fact that it is more homogenized. So usually that word means, you know, that's progress and that's technology taking over and we're losing the human element. But in this case, I love the fact that you can pretty much bank on what the strike zone is and not have to think about who the umpire is.
And I think that speaks, like you just mentioned it, and I had just written it down, that there's no need, I don't think, for a robo umpire. I think these guys are getting dialed into the point now where it is becoming, you know, what to expect. This pitch is going to be strike ball, et cetera. Although, like I said, if you look at heat maps, there's a little advantage to be gained from a catcher and a pitcher with some kind of command. I mean, a lot of the throwers today, they really can't dial it up or dot a corner, whatever. But there's something to be gained regarding where to sit, like maybe with two strikes, knowing that this guy's going to be a little bit more liberal in that particular area than some others. So the robo umpire, I would hope never happens. Like I said, I think the teaching method today is kind of dissuading that to the point where maybe we just don't need this. But like you're saying, maybe late in the game, I have to wrap my mind around that because I've been watching the NBA playoffs. I'm a pseudo Knicks fan. And I'm watching all this stuff down at the end of the game where there's challenging calls. I didn't know they can do that. And it's kind of weird. It's because it's such an arbitrary basketball. You can almost call a foul on every play. And you can almost, in football, you could almost call a penalty on every play. So it kind of bothers me a little bit. But I like the idea of umpires being umpires, more autonomous, because they have become kind of like very consistent.
Yeah, and you know, not to pick on Hunter Winkelstedt here, but that particular day, he had a bad game behind the plate. And what you said about, you know, the particular strike zones or heat maps for umpires, you can see with Hunter Winkelstedt, when he sets up, and he sets up like most umpires on the inside corner, whether it's a lefty or a righty hitter, he'll be on the inside corner. He's got a blind spot on the outside corner to right-handed hitters. And he missed basically one-third of his strike calls in that game. I mean, they should have about an 88, 89% correct accuracy call on balls that are called strikes. Most pitches are obvious. So in that game, there were 47 pitches that he called strikes. He was wrong on 15 of those. That's way too high. And almost all of them were off the plate to right-handed hitters. Now, what you're saying, Joe, and I understand this, a pitcher with command can take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. A lot of pitchers today just don't have the command to take advantage to get that ball one width of a ball outside and get that call. But again, the older umpires to me, Joe, and the game has moved a lot faster, you know, whether it's something physical where they don't see that outside corner as well, whether it's eyesight, I don't know. But we saw in the postseason last year, the guys who made it to the World Series, the youngest crew ever, and we're seeing that year in and year out now in the last few years, that the younger umpires are grading out much higher. Again, they've been on the laser tracking system their whole careers. And again, I'm not bashing Hunter Winkelstedt. He's a great umpire. But in that game, I think it showed the human element that he had a blind spot, a way to right-handed hitters, and a good pitcher can take advantage of that.
I've always thought, because the umpire normally does sit up on the inside edge of the plate. He gets inside right on right like a right-handed hitter. He'll be on the left shoulder of the catcher. So I've always believed you're guessing on the outside edge. It's the inconsistent area to rely on a consistent version of a strike zone. Whereas on the inside corner, they see it so well, I think they become very tight on the inside corner. So I've always thought that the inside edge, you're going to miss some strikes. They're going to be strikes that are going to be called balls because he thinks he sees them so well. And actually the strike zone kind of shifts. You move that little box to the right on right hitter, pitcher, the box shifts to the right based on where the umpire sets up. You remember back in the day with the balloon protectors, the umpire used to be right over the top of the catcher. But then again, they thought the low pitch was not being called because of that. And there's all different ways. I mean, a foot position, I used to hate when an umpire got his foot right outside my foot to the point where he could block me trying to move to block a pitch because the umpire got so close. I hate it when an umpire put his hand on my back. Could not stand when an umpire put his hand on my back. Again, you feel restricted somehow. So all these things I think have been cleaned up over time. But when I used to work with my catchers, I would always ask them to be aware of the outside edge. When he's on your inside shoulder, normally I thought it was a more liberal strike, whereas the inner side of the plate, the inside edge, was more conservative.
You know, I'm glad you said that about the umpire putting his hand on the catcher's back, because when I see that, it bothers me. I mean, would you turn around and tell the dude, hey, take your hand off my back? Or do you think, you know what, I can't say that because we're not going to get any calls?
And then the other thing I'm telling you, the foot, when he placed his foot like right outside my left foot as an example, and the ball's thrown down and in on that side, you go to move and his foot blocks your movement. So that used to be big when the umpire wanted to get really in close like that again to see the low ball or the ball down and away. And that bothered me. And that happened several times. You go to move and then it's your fault. Nobody knows, but he would block you out. I like when the umpire gives me a little bit of room. I like a conversation with my umpire during a game. And one of the things I always taught my catchers, don't ever try to talk a umpire into a strike that was legitimately a ball and you knew it was a ball. I said, you're losing all credibility with this man. I always like to, if I thought he made a good call on a pitch that I wanted, but it was a ball, I would say, man, on the money, good call. That was a ball. So then I always believe that when I wanted a pitch and I thought it was accurate, like a strike, for instance, obviously, that he'd listen to me more. So there's a little give and take going on during the course of the game conversationally. And I believe that we're both human beings. I think, and I always believe that the umpire wanted some honesty from me. And Dana DeMuta and I had a running conversation even in the California League. I mean, it was always important. So that's another thing I think that's not even discussed is the conversation between the pitcher and the umpire during the game regarding what is a strike and what is a ball. Hey, listen, I need that pitch, man. This guy's a sinker ball pitcher. We need the ball down. I got to have that, you know, something to that effect. That might have been a borderline pitch that he's calling a ball that I think is a strike. Conversation's big.
So as a catcher, you want to know your umpire. As a manager, you don't.
Very good. That's exactly right. I did. As an umpire, I didn't because I just ended up arguing with him all the time. Very good. That's really well defined.
Hey, when we get back, I'm going to put you on the spot, Joe. We lost a rock and roll legend, and I'm guessing that Joe Maddon was a big fan of this dude. We'll talk about that right after this.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to the Book of Joe podcast. And we did lose another rock and roll legend in the past week, and that was Dickie Betts, famous guitarist of the Allman Brothers Band, one of the founding members of that band. And I first thought of Joe Madden because I could definitely see Joe Madden cruising the streets of Hazleton or, I don't know, Lafayette maybe with Allman Brothers cranked up. Listen to Blue Sky or Jessica. Give me your thoughts, Joe. Allman Brothers, Dickie Betts.
You cannot be more right. At Lafayette College, the Allman Brothers were huge. I remember staying up to 5 o'clock in the morning in one of my buddy's rooms, and we're just banging on the Allman Brothers. And that's where I got to know who Dickie Betts was. My friends, classmates were ahead of me with that, and then I learned from them. But Jessica is one of my all time favorite jams, man. I just absolutely love that. Of course, Ramblin' Man, you could go up and down the list. They were just that good. They were very viscerally influential for me in that period of time. You just turn it up. You turn it up and you get lost in the sound. And you know from the very first note or two that it is the Allman Brothers. There's no like, who is this? You know exactly who it is. The Allman Brothers themselves. I mean, wow. It was a big moment for me. And yes, it was huge at Lafayette College. I would drive, whether it was my old Volvo, my Thunderbird, or eventually, I don't know what else I had after that, a Ford Galaxy. But it was always blasting, man. And I was surprised. I didn't realize he was that old. I should have known that. But gonna miss him, man. He was that influential. He was that great.
Yeah, it's a great word, influential, Joe, because they pretty much invented what we now call Southern rock, paving the way for a lot of bands, you know, ZZ Top, Fish, I mean, you name it, that distinctive sound. And how about the fact that you mentioned this, Jessica, you could have on FM radio a 7.5 minute song with no lyrics and be a hit. I mean, think about that. It can't happen today.
No, that it was. I mean, it's like it came on and it was like, that's one of those songs you love from the first time you heard it. You didn't have to hear it the second time. You knew, oh my God, I love that. You know, I can't wait till that comes back on, because that back then you had to wait for it to come back on, you know, and then, or unless you had the turntable, you throw your album on, cassettes maybe, but you had to find where it was. You got to rewind it all the time. That's what people don't realize, youngsters today. I mean, getting to the song that you like, you had to wait sometimes on that AM radio. It wasn't just popping up and you just couldn't query it and throw it right in there. So, when I heard that song, I was absolutely, you had me right there, man. And yes, that is kind of like, for me, Jessica, Ramblin' Man, pretty much, that is the Allman Brothers.
Ramblin' Man was pretty much his life story.
Yeah, I mean,
he left home, you know, his father worked in construction. They kind of bounced around a bit, and he left home actually to join the circus. He played in a circus band at the age of 16. And as he sang and wrote in Ramblin' Man, he's talking about Highway 41 in Bradenton.
Right.
You know that area well,
yo,
Joe.
I think about it every time I drive up
and down. I would never write a song about Highway 41. I've been stuck in traffic there way too often, but he did, and it's a classic.
Brother, I do. I drive up and down there, and I start singing it out loud. I mean, the thing is, and we've talked about this, and you're talking about the struggle again, right? And it's such a romantic thought to me that a guy like this did other things. And while he's doing these other things, whether it's working in a circus or whatever, I would bet that Dickie Betts always just wanted to be this rock and roll guitar player. So he eventually became that. How much time did he practice? How many thoughts did he have? How many notes did he write down? How many pickup bands, garage bands did he work with until this finally hit for him? And then when it does, God, the guy knows his craft. I have so much respect for that. Because like you and I have talked about the struggle before, the real true artist, man. The real artists, the people that know their stuff, not just think they know their stuff or stuff is presented to them and they put their name on it. These guys have just bled that stuff. And I got so much respect for that. There's a romantic component to that to me that always takes me back immediately. And perfect example when you talk about a Dickie Betts starting in a circus and ended up being one of the most influential guitar players ever.
Yeah, and you know, it goes back to another one of our favorite themes too, Joe, and that is pure intentions, mm-hmm. right? I mean, he wasn't, by any measure, a cookie-cutter guy trying to, how do I get on the top 40 charts? You know, just following his instincts and his passions and his loves, and that works no matter what you do. And we talk a lot about that with managing as well, that you're not trying to manage by a template. It has to be that balance between art and science and data and gut. And guys like Dickie Betts, you know, listen, he clashed with Wayne Allman. They wound up actually kicking him out of the band. He was so uncompromising in what his standards were and following his artistic muse, if you will. But always true to himself. And I think that's a lifelong lesson for all of us that, you know, you copy from others in terms of you see what works. You pay attention to where the industry is going. But in general, Joe, you know this, if you follow your heart, you're going to wind up in a good place.
100%. That's always been my advice to young coaches, managers, whatever. But the thing is, Dickie Betts knew. He knew what he knew. I mean, for lack of a better way of saying it, too many times, I think today, we only know what people tell us to know or something that's been handed to us to know. But you don't really know what you know because you've never really struggled, lived through it, paycheck to paycheck, how am I going to do this, whatever those difficult moments were back then. It's just different, man. The phrase, and I've talked about some people about this recently, actually, is that you got to know whatever you're involved in, you got to know exactly what we're talking about, have lived it, made mistakes with it, got your butt kicked with it. We're told you're not good enough for it. I mean, all the different things. So you have to fight back. Eventually you got it. And then you're not going to be dissuaded. I believe this. I'll tell people, if I'm really not committed or totally, devoted to a thought, I'm very malleable. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to listen and eventually we'll come to a conclusion. But if I'm really hard, fast, that I've been through this before and I really like this and I know what I'm talking about right here, you're not going to push me in a direction. So I think that's the best way to have this malleableness about you, that if you're really not sure about a situation, yeah, find about as much information as you can. But once you know what you know, put it out there, man, in your inimitable style, whatever that might be, put it out there because that authenticity plays and people will follow you because of that.
That's a great way to put it because it's a great legacy to have for someone like Dickie Betts or anybody mm-hmm. is that you're one of a kind. It's who you are. You're not compared to others. They paved their own path. The Allman Brothers didn't, especially Dickie Betts. So very well said about that inimitable uniqueness, authenticity. Mm-hmm. Well mm-hmm. said. Mm-hmm. It's time now for the Joe Madden last out of the game here. Our closer, Joe, always brings us to the end of the game here with words of wisdom, and they're always somehow appropriate to the subject matter. So now they put the pressure on you, Joe.
You did.
You got the ball.
Well, you know, one of the things I might have mentioned this to you, I'll text Brian Butterfield on occasion, my former coach, great guy, great coach. And I would text him in the morning and I'll say, Butter, I'm too quick today. I'm too fast. And he'll laugh and he'll send something back. He'll send scripture back to me to help me slow down. But I was looking this up today, and a guy by the name of Pico Iyer, and this is a Buddhist kind of a concept or principle, which I kind of into a little bit right now. I think it's awesome. But he came up with this thought, and I think, again, it applies to just arguing too much or whatever. Again, trying to be too fast. But in the age of speed, I began to think nothing could be more invigorating than going slow. In an age of distraction, nothing can feel more luxurious than paying attention. I've always talked about being a good listener and slowing it down. So when I saw this today, it just really resonated with me. So I went with that today. Slow things down a little bit, folks, and really pay attention to whomever you're speaking with and don't walk over their conversations. You might actually learn something.
Oh, I love that thought. And we definitely need to be reminded of that on a daily basis, because it does seem like life gets faster and faster. We live in such a microwave world. Mm-hmm. We need to rediscover the joys of slow-baked ovens, you know, take time, craft things, craft ideas, craft your work, and not be in such a hurry. That's a great reminder any day of the week.
Thanks, man. I'm really into it. I am.
Great job, Joe. We'll see you next time.
You too, brothers. See you soon.
The Book of Joe podcast is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home, where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.